Hello and welcome to Late Night Live with me, Norman Swan, filling in for Philip Adams, who I'm delighted to say, and no doubt you are too, will be back next week. Tonight, or today if you're listening to the repeat, the Scottish writer and journalist Andrew O'Hagan on child jihadis, child criminals and memories of Scotland. Andrew comes from not far from where I grew up and from the same town as Australian actor Colin Friels. Andrew O'Hagan is coming in later, and fear not, I'll provide a simultaneous translation. There appears to be a growing confidence that indeed an appalling chemical attack took place in Syria last week, even though definitive evidence of what happened and who did it has yet to emerge from the UN investigators on the ground. The United States, the UK and some other countries have decided the Assad regime is behind this attack and that punishment needs to be meted out with or without UN Security Council approval. US warships have gathered off the Syrian coast, and as we go to air, the BBC is reporting that British fighters have been sent to Cyprus. On Monday's programme, analyst Joshua Landis argued that while it's hard not to respond to such an outrage, any conceivable action would result in making things worse and more chaotic and dangerous. But will the US take military action against the Syrian government without UN security backing as it did with Iraq? And at what point does the moral obligation to protect civilians outweigh the lack of legality of such actions? Having thought long and hard about these issues, given his involvement in the UN's responsibility to protect doctrine, and as former chief executive of the International Crisis Group, is Gareth Evans, who's former Foreign Minister of Australia. Welcome to Late Night Live.
Good evening, Norman. Nice to talk to you.
Now, you argued this morning in the Fin Review that even an extreme case like this isn't necessarily grounds for legally authorising a military response. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, unhappily, even if you've got an extreme breach of international law, that doesn't in itself legally authorise a coercive military response. States individually or in coalition can apply sanctions, they can seek to get people before international criminal courts, but if they're going to take military action, you've got to do it within the terms of the UN Charter, and the Charter says that coercive military action is only possible in really two circumstances. One, self-defence, which is obviously not applicable here, and secondly, with a resolution under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, which authorises force if the Security Council so approves without anyone vetoing it. And that's where we're stuck at the moment. I mean, some UK and US lawyers are wriggling around trying to argue that there's some kind of exception under customary international law, that state practice is prepared to contemplate intervention in circumstances of really dramatic breach of humanitarian law or dramatic breach of, you know, civilian protection boundaries. But frankly, there's no basis for doing that. It's making it up as you go along.
But doesn't Chapter 8 allow some sort of regional grouping to come together?
Yeah, there's one other little loophole that's potentially available, and that is under Chapter 8 of the UN Charter, which says that if there's a regional organisation, and this has happened in West Africa with Nigeria and the ECOWAS and Liberia and Sierra Leone, if that group operates in a collective way to take action to deal with some catastrophic situation like Charles Taylor in Liberia, then that's sort of permissible, provided the Security Council at some later stage gives us imprimatur.
But in this case, Iran is hardly likely to punish its own ally.
No, but if the Arab League turns its general condemnation into a willingness to engage itself in some kind of military attack or contribution to a military attack mounted by NATO, US-led, then there's the beginnings of an argument there, the beginnings of an argument that maybe that's sort of justified. But, I mean, it really only postpones the problem because at the end of the day, you do need Security Council ex post facto endorsement for it. So I think the bottom line in all of this is we've got to start with the premise that whichever way we twist and turn and however hard we look, we're not going to find a legal basis for this. It really has to be premised on morality. And that's not an unreasonable basis for the international community to act, as we found in Kosovo in 1999 in very, very similar circumstances where the Russians threatened to apply a veto and made effectively impossible a Security Council resolution to authorise a military response to Milosevic's genocidal intervention in Kosovo.
Before we get to, because again in the Fin Review today you outlined five criteria that needed to be fulfilled for that moral action to take place, but before we get there, what role does the responsibility to protect play in all this?
Responsibility to protect doctrine evolved in the early part of the 2000s, partly out of an international commission that I co-chaired, in which we were wrestling with the dilemma posed by all those catastrophic mass atrocity crimes in the 1990s, for which there had been no international consensus. And the doctrine basically says that each sovereign state has a responsibility to protect its own people against genocide and other mass atrocity crimes, that the wider international community has a responsibility to assist it to do so if it's in a mood to be assisted, and when a state manifestly fails in that responsibility, is itself guilty of perpetrating mass atrocity crimes in particular, then under those circumstances, the rest of the international community is in principle thoroughly justified, indeed has a responsibility to take timely and decisive collective action, including even military action, provided that, again, and this is the bottom line, provided that is endorsed by the Security Council. So what we've got is a new norm which has been unanimously embraced by the international community at the General Assembly in 2005, and which has sustained a rather more, you know, systematic and principled response to these situations than we saw in the 90s. I mean, justifying the military intervention, in particular in Libya and Cote d'Ivoire in 2011. We've seen this evolving over the last decade, and it clearly is a case in Syria, if the evidence hangs this on the Assad regime, it's clearly a case of a mass atrocity crime which breaches the responsibility to protect principle. But again, it doesn't help you with any new legal justification. At best, it's a moral justification for action, and that's the dilemma which we now face.
Did the French have the Security Council take for Mali?
Say again?
Did the French...
For Mali, yeah, basically they did. There was a resolution invoking their responsibility to protect doctrine, which was not an explicit mandate in Mali, but there was a general international acquiescence in that, and acknowledgement that the French engagement, which was, of course, with the support of the Malian government itself against a perceived rebel revolt in its north. So it wasn't really a situation where you were sending in troops against the will of
against the sovereign nation. Yeah.
No, so, I mean, Mali's off to one side. I mean, the interest of Mali from a responsibility to protect point of view is that the Security Council, even though it's been divided on so many things on these issues over the last couple of years, actually said that Mali was a legitimate case where atrocity crimes were being perpetrated and where it was appropriate that that principle applied. But it's not the same as when you're going in against the will of a sovereign government. And that's the problem we've obviously got in Syria.
So assuming politically that Russia vetoes the decision, a decision of the Security Council, which is highly likely, then you come to this moral argument that you're making, and you talk about five conditions which need to be met. What are they?
Well, these have been around for a decade or so since they were articulated in again, the commission report that I was involved in 10 years ago, and have surfaced in other contexts, although they haven't been formally embraced by the Security Council. In short, number one is that the scale of the threat to civilians is prima facie such as to justify a military response. Secondly, that the intention of the potential interveners is genuinely geared to meeting that threat. It's not about protecting oil interests or something of that kind. Subjective criterion, if you like. The third criterion is last resort. But no lesser measures, nothing else than military measures will actually do the job of stopping the harm or putting in place a sufficient deterrent to that harm continuing in the future. The fourth criterion is proportionality, that the nature of the response has to be, you know, proportional to the gravity of the harm that's being perpetrated. And the fifth criterion, often the most difficult to satisfy, is the balance of consequences, that a military response not put those who it's meaning to protect in even greater peril as a result of that. Now, all of those criteria, I think, probably can be satisfied in the Syrian case right now.
But not
the last one is pretty tricky. The last one really is pretty tricky. The balance of consequences one always is, because what are you getting into if you mount a military attack? And that's been part of the argument against a military response to the Syrian situation before the chemical weapons situation erupted, and arguably it hasn't changed all that much as a result of chemicals coming into play, other than the need to be seen to be doing something about what is a wholly new dimension to the Syrian catastrophe, and that is the use of these unconscionable weapons of mass destruction. But they're very finely balanced, those criteria, and it's very important that the US and others traveling with the US make a clear-cut case, not just on the evidence issue, but also on the issue of how these criteria are satisfied.
And it's hard to know where you would make a surgical strike, given that these were likely...
Well, it's the other big issue. When you have decided that all these criteria are satisfied and there's morally a case that even if it's not legal, it's legitimate, to use the language of the Kosovo days, then you've got to decide what is the nature precisely of the military operation that is justified and appropriate in these circumstances. And I think what we're talking about here is something that will be a demonstrable deterrent to the use of chemical weapons in the future. It's not a matter of trying to mount a military operation which will rid the scene of chemical weapons. I think that's just incredibly complex and difficult to accomplish. And there runs the all sorts of physical risks of the dispersal of the chemicals if you try to attack stockpiles where they're held. I think what it basically means is some kind of attack on military assets, just to make very, very clear that this can't be pain-free or scot-free to the Assad regime. The other point about the military response is that it really has to be focused on deterring the use of chemical weapons and civilian protection if it even begins to savour of a regime change exercise, that this is really an exercise in generalized war fighting designed to overthrow the Assad regime, you're going to lose a vast amount of international support, which otherwise potentially is there. And that's what happened in Libya, I'm afraid, and that's why we've got so little consensus now about the Syrian situation.
And indeed, which of the 1,000 militias are you going to hand over the regime to?
Well, I mean, there's no easy distinction between black hats and white hats on the rebel side in this case, and that's been again a huge problem.
So if you were, if you've
been disgusted by the Assad regime, but equally unimpressed by the credentials of the opposition.
So Gareth Evans, if you had your finger on the button, what would you actually do?
Well, I think I'd do what the Americans are probably almost certainly determined to do, and that is powerful cruise missile strikes against some significant military installations in a way that demonstrates in a finite sort of a way, not open-ended, that when you do something as horrific as the evidence seems to be that the regime has done, you can't possibly expect to get away with that. And if we can do something like this, which does have some sort of effective deterrent impact, then I think that's probably about as much as it's possible for the international community to do. Because you are sort of out there on a bit of a limb. Once you move into this twilight zone of relying on moral justifications rather than legal ones, you are sort of potentially putting at risk the whole principle of a rule-based international order, which countries like Australia ought to be very, very firmly hanging their hat on. So it's got to be very, very careful. It's got to be very, very calibrated. But it's got to send, I think, an unmistakable message. I've wrestled with this. Everybody's wrestled with it. It's a wicked problem, classic wicked problem, because every possible option for addressing the Syrian situation has terrible downside risks associated with it. But the use of chemical weapons, if indeed that's provable, you know, is a game changer, and I think it does demand upping the ante in the way that the Americans are talking about.
And we will see very shortly, I think, according to today's news, whether the US does have evidence of its own without waiting for the UN.
Well, it's going to have to be a whole lot better, obviously, than they produced in the context of Iraq, and
yes,
we hope that they'll be prepared to put on the record then, you know, signals, intelligence, or whatever it is on which they're primarily relying, because it's pretty obvious the inspectors on the ground are going to find it very, very difficult to get the physical evidence that will be decisive in terms of not only what happened.
So they're relying on this panic phone call that they heard.
Yeah, which, I mean, that sort of evidence can be quite compelling and quite decisive, but we've got to see what it is. We can't just take it on trust.
Gareth Evans, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thanks, Norman. Appreciate it.
Gareth Evans, Chancellor of the Australian National University, former head of the International Crisis Group and former Foreign Minister of Australia. This is Late Night Live on Radio National with me, Norman Swan. Coming up, Scottish author, novelist and essayist, Andrew O'Hagan.